Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Here on WFMU, Freeform Station of the Nation, live from Jersey City in that great state of New Jersey. It is a pleasure to be here with you. And I'm so glad you have joined because I've got a great interview to share with you this evening. We're going to be speaking with Tim Schwab, who has written a book called The Bill Gates Problem, Reckoning with the Myth of the Good Billionaire. The book is just out in paperback, and there's a link to it on the playlist at WFMU.org. This book, The Bill Gates Problem, is covering Bill Gates, of course, who, if you don't know, is the co-founder of Microsoft and more recently has been heavily involved in his foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which is a key focus of Tim Schwab's book. And what you learn in this book is that through his work in his foundation, Bill Gates wields enormous influence in world affairs in a number of different areas. And a lot of people don't know this. They may know some bits and pieces about what the foundation does that have been filtered through the almost exclusively positive press that the foundation manages to get. But most people don't understand the full range of Bill Gates's influence. And so we're going to dip into that a little bit in this interview with Tim Schwab. If you are interested in joining the live listener chat during the show, go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comments. And you can also see links to Tim's book and a couple of other items that if I have time after the interview, I'll be able to cover. With that, let's go ahead and listen to my interview now with Tim Schwab here at Tectonic on WFMU. Tim Schwab, welcome to Tectonic.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
I'm excited to talk with you about your book, The Bill Gates Problem, which just came out in paperback. The book takes a critical look at Bill Gates, the co-founder of Microsoft, and his foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, through which Bill Gates exerts massive influence in world affairs, including in areas like pharmaceuticals, agriculture, journalism, and more. But people tend not to understand this. Most people, if they know about the Gates Foundation at all, will say, oh, aren't they curing malaria or something like that? Which is a dangerously narrow view of what Gates is up to. In this book, The Bill Gates Problem, what are you trying to reveal to us, Tim, about Bill Gates and his foundation?
So I approached this book as an investigative journalist. And the way they teach journalism, at least in the United States, is that it's your job to afflict the comforted and comfort the afflicted. And if that's really your mission and you're a journalist looking at someone like Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation, you should really be putting a critical lens to them. And what I'm doing in the book is looking at the Gates Foundation as a political organization, not as a philanthropy. If you start to peel back the layers of the onion, it becomes very clear very quickly. You see Bill Gates flying around the world, meeting with elected leaders, shaping government priorities and spending billions of dollars of taxpayer spending on everything from public health to public education to climate policy to vaccine policy to contraceptive policy. You know, all of us have our own narrow ideas about how to fix public policies, but not all of us have a $130 billion private fortune and a $75 billion private foundation that we can use to buy a seat at the democratic decision-making table, to really have our own solutions and to put them into action through our great wealth. So it's really, I'm examining the Gates Foundation as unregulated political influence that really demands our attention. I think we're really long overdue to have an open, honest debate about what Gates is actually doing, not just what he says he's doing.
Now, on the other hand, there is the devil's advocate position, which you do a good job of voicing and engaging with throughout the book. For example, some people will say, hey, if Bill Gates made all that money, shouldn't he have the right to spend it as he sees fit? And by the way, he's spending it on global health, not yachts or mansions. So isn't that a good thing? What do you say to those arguments?
Yeah, and that's what has made Bill Gates such a tricky target for so many journalists, I think, over the years, is that, you know, who's going to criticize a billionaire for giving away all of his money? And the problem is that the actual truth of what Bill Gates is doing is not at all that. So again, he's not giving away money. He's buying influence. He's buying democratic control over public policy, often in ways that are very wrongheaded and counterproductive. It's an argument I make throughout the book, and I think I provide substantial evidence to support it, which we can talk about, you know, as we go on. But in many places, the Gates Foundation is actually doing more harm than good. But beneath the Gates Foundation, you know, this nice fairy tale of this wealthy guy who's giving away all of his money, you know, it's just contradiction after contradiction. During Bill Gates's philanthropic career, in which he's supposedly giving away all of his money, he's managed to double his personal wealth. You know, how is it? How can these things both be true, that he's giving away all of his money, but over the last 25 years, he's doubled his personal fortune? He's becoming richer over time. Is he really generous or is he greedy? So those are the kinds of things that I think if you take any time at all to look at the Gates Foundation, to look at Bill Gates beyond the sort of public relations, you see that it's a much more complex and I'd say much more contradictory story, certainly a much more interesting story.
Well, let's get into an example. Early in the book, you have a chapter on the Gates Foundation and its work with pharmaceuticals. You go into great detail about the close relationships that the foundation has with pharma companies like Merck and Bayer, as well as a lot of medium and smaller pharmaceutical companies. Here's something I didn't realize. You write about how the foundation, in many cases, stands to benefit financially if those companies do well.
Yes, this gets into a very murky area. Scholars have this term philanthrocapitalism. It's a big $100 word to describe what is, you know, the Gates Foundation is working very closely with and through for the private sector. In agricultural development, it works closely with agrochemical companies. In public health, it works very closely with pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, that's certainly one way to try to advance public health, is to try and work with and through pharmaceutical companies. But it's not the only way, and I'd say it's not the most efficient way. In a lot of ways, what this is doing is giving this kind of philanthropic halo to big pharma that it doesn't deserve. And in doing so, it legitimizes and normalizes their business model, which I think is deeply unfair, inequitable, unjust, and it guarantees that the poorest people in the world won't have access to pharmaceuticals. So, I mean, to your specific question, you know, the foundation today, it's super counterintuitive for anyone who understands the common definition of philanthropy, of giving away money. But what the Gates Foundation does is it actively partners with pharmaceutical companies. It's providing seed money to create new pharmaceutical companies. It's sitting on the boards of directors of pharmaceutical companies. It's donating money to private pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer. It's making investments in pharmaceutical companies. And the way someone like Bill Gates can rationalize and justify all this is to say, well, you know, we are helping big pharma help the global poor, that our partnerships with them will open up access to the pharmaceuticals that they're selling that would otherwise be out of touch. As the foundation says, we're making markets work for the poor. You know, that is, you know, like to your point about the devil's advocacy, I didn't have access to the Gates Foundation or Bill Gates. They wouldn't communicate with me for this book. But I do feel like I did a very, earnest job of trying to represent their position, trying to state what their position is. But then you can look at its decades of work in pharmaceutical access. And I think you'd have to, if you just look at it on paper in black and white, you know, the Gates Foundation can produce research studies, fund research studies, showing all the lives that they claim to save, but that's only telling, you know, a very narrow version of the story. It's not considering the millions of lives that have been lost from poor people who can't access medication for some of the very same reasons that the Gates Foundation, you know, puts into play through their work with the pharmaceutical industry.
Here's a note I took in the pharma chapter. I wrote, Tim's telling us the template of how the foundation works. Bill Gates decides what should happen and announces that. The foundation forms partnerships with giant companies to sell their pharmaceuticals at a discount that is still profitable to the companies, and then Gates declares victory. So it seems to be centered first on whether the pharma company will benefit and less on, is this the exact solution that people on the ground actually need?
Yeah, and sort of a central contradiction in this discussion about public health and pharmaceutical access is that millions of people die every year because they're too poor to afford medicines that we have available, diagnostics, vaccines, therapeutics. They can't afford them. So there's different ways to deal with that access problem. You know, one, during the pandemic, for example, you had around the world public health experts in poor nations who said we should waive the patents over COVID vaccines. We should get every capable manufacturer in the world scaling up production. We should be helping facilities in poor nations, like in sub-Saharan Africa, to produce their own vaccines so they could vaccinate their own people, rather than waiting on the goodwill of philanthropists in Seattle and the pharmaceutical companies in New Jersey to slowly, glacially slowly hand out doses of vaccines. So, you know, one way to deal with pharmaceutical access is to waive the patents, to challenge Big Pharma. Another way, the Gates model, is working with Big Pharma. And this is that gets into the kind of the Swiss cheese win-win solutions that you're talking about, where Gates gets to claim victory for saving lives. Big Pharma, they get this humanitarian halo because they worked with the Gates Foundation to deliver vaccine access, contraceptive access, therapeutics, diagnostics, whatever it is. But it's not really addressing the main problem. And that model will never deliver anything that is actually verging on real equity or real justice. You know, there are a lot of different ways to solve these problems. And, you know, for what it's worth, the work of Gates in pharmaceuticals and public health, this is the Gates Foundation's most successful body of work. And that's why I put it at the very front of the book, to give them really the best and the fair shake as to what they're doing. If we talk about Gates' work in education and agriculture and some of these other areas, it becomes much, much harder to even start a mount an argument that they've done anything successful. I don't argue that in the book that Bill Gates has designed his philanthropy in order to make money. You know, I think he's well-intentioned in the sense that he himself really believes that he's helping the world, that he's the smartest guy in the room, and that he has the right political ideas, that he knows better than anyone else how to solve problems. He certainly knows better than poor African farmers how to improve agriculture. And that kind of hubris and his great wealth gives him this ability to go all over the world meddling in public policy and trying to rearrange how the world works for all of us, even in rich nations, and like you see in U.S. education. So it's not that Bill Gates isn't well-meaning, if that's not really the right word. But I just think that as a model of power, giving someone this much money and allowing them to give it away and call it philanthropy to buy political influence over how pharmaceutical markets and public health and public education, all these things work. I just think it's a fundamentally anti-democratic model, and it really raises the specter of oligarchy. The richest guy gets the loudest voice. That's the only way we can really make sense of what Bill Gates is doing philanthropically.
Yeah, the title of the book is The Bill Gates Problem, and there were a couple of instances in the book where I came across something that I felt was a good definition or summation of what exactly the Bill Gates problem is. One of them, near the end of the book, you're quoting a source in India on your chapter on India, said the following: "One man deciding what is good for the entire world is highly problematic. How does one man know what is good for everybody?" And I thought that was a nice summation of what the Bill Gates problem is, this asymmetry of power of one man, maybe well-intentioned, but we should never have a system where one man makes the decisions for everybody.
Absolutely. And that source, like so many of the sources in the book, are people who have worked with the Gates Foundation. You know, the book is heavily written from sources who either work for the Gates Foundation or with the Gates Foundation, individuals and groups that have taken charitable grants from the Gates Foundation, who know the foundation inside and out. Yeah, I think that when you're talking about Gates's work abroad, I think there is an important story about colonialism in the way that this is a super wealthy white guy from Seattle. You know, what does he really know about the lived experience of people in these poor nations? What does he know about farming in sub-Saharan Africa? You know, what does he really know about all of these fields in which he claims expertise and claims authority and power? How do we make sense of this model of power? Is this a good thing?
Yeah, you're right that the simple fact is Bill Gates doesn't have the expertise, training, or education in most of the topics where he asserts it, which just stands to reason. I mean, he made his career as a software monopolist, making not very good software. And how does that translate into, like you said, into farming and public policy in places very different from Washington State? You write early in the book about a really extraordinary case of an organization turning down an offer from the foundation. And here I'm talking about Doctors Without Borders. A few years ago, the foundation offered through, I think it was through their partner company, Gavi, is that right, to distribute a lot of medicine that Doctors Without Borders would be able to acquire or purchase at a discount, and they turned down the deal. Can you say what happened there?
I think if memory serves, this is a pneumonia vaccine that Pfizer and this massive charitable procurement mechanism that Gates has created called Gavi have organized. And Doctors Without Borders wanted to, I mean, they were making a very modest request, which was to access the pneumonia vaccine at the same prices that Gavi accessed it. And Pfizer was refusing to do that, but they were offering to donate a limited number of doses to Doctors Without Borders. And if memory serves, they publicly refused that offer because doing so, I think, in their mind, would legitimize or normalize the extreme market power, the monopoly power that Pfizer had in the marketplace. You know, we've had pneumonia vaccines for more than 20 years. But it's still one of the leading, today it's one of the leading causes of vaccine preventable deaths around the world. You're talking about, you know, many, many, many children around the world that need this vaccine, that should have this vaccine, but can't access it. They can't access it because it's too expensive. They can't access it because of this grand public-private partnership that Bill Gates has created. It only goes so far. You know, after two decades of work with the Pfizers of the world, with the GSKs, with Big Pharma to try and negotiate deals and to get access, you still have a huge number of children around the world who aren't getting vaccinated. And you have a huge number of people who are dying because they deaths that would otherwise be prevented from vaccination. So the story of the Gates Foundation is really of extremely limited success. And what you find is you find, you know, many experts who have looked at this who said that the Gates's solutions are actually putting up obstacles to the real solution that would actually grant access to do things like challenge the monopoly power that Big Pharma has in the marketplace that allows one or two or three companies to control the vaccine technology for a very important disease. Again, Bill Gates has his own narrow ideas about how the world and marketplaces should work. I think it's informed, just as you said, from his days at Microsoft, his days as one of the world's most storied monopolists. You know, the world of software and technology is very, very similar to the world of pharmaceuticals. And it's not a coincidence that Gates' philanthropic career is organized around the same kinds of markets and the same kinds of products. Just like Microsoft puts a lot of money into research and development to develop the new operating system, which is then cheap or essentially free to hand out, pharmaceutical companies, the big costs are in the research and development to produce the vaccine or the drug. And once it's there, it's relatively cheap and easy to produce it. The way that they make their profits is by having the intellectual property or the patent rights to be able to really monopolize control, whether it's Microsoft and the software it sells or whether it's Pfizer and the vaccines that it sells. And in Gates' mind, this is the way the world works. You have a small number of massive multinational companies that exercise monopoly or oligopoly power in the marketplace. These are very sophisticated, you know, multinational companies. They have the regulatory wherewithal. They know how to do this professionally, effectively, safely. You know, in Gates' mind, that's just the way the world works. And it's not at all surprising to see him reproduce that market making, that imagination of how markets should work in his work as a philanthropist with pharmaceuticals. I mean, the real problem is, and this is what the ultimate referendum on that work was, the foundation's work during the pandemic. And I've kind of already given that example, but there was an alternative on the table. You had more than 100 poor nations around the world. These are the poor nations that Bill Gates claims to be helping as a philanthropist, that were openly petitioning the World Trade Organization, asking for a waiver of patents over the COVID vaccine as a first step to ramp up production. And again and again and again, Bill Gates went in front of the TV cameras and said, this is a bad idea. We shouldn't waive the patents. We're already operating at full speed. I'm talking to the pharmaceutical CEOs. Every capable manufacturer everywhere in the world is already running at full speed. So it was the ultimate referendum because it shows the limitations of the Gates model of working with the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, just to state the obvious, what happened was, what we saw during the pandemic was vaccine apartheid, where the poorest people went to the back of the line. They couldn't afford access to these vaccines, which were controlled by a handful of large companies. So they either didn't get vaccinated, got sick, or died. And this was totally predictable. You know, you had public health experts from the very beginning of the pandemic saying, we can't do this big pharma business as usual model. There is an alternative on the table. We'll call it the people's vaccine. We'll waive the patents. We'll get every capable manufacturer up and running. What Bill Gates does is really circumvent what should be a democratic process to figure that out, in the same way that moneyed interests always do that. You know, it wasn't Bill Gates alone. He had big pharma on his side. He had the wealthy nations where big pharma are domiciled. You know, it wasn't Bill Gates acting alone, but he certainly wasn't helpful in that political fight. And we saw, you know, what the outcome of that was.
So you have a software monopolist talking to pharmaceutical monopolists about how to make arrangements so that their medicines are delivered to shore up the monopolies and ensure that people everywhere are being served only by the monopolists. And
somehow we call that humanitarianism, philanthropy. You know, it's just, it's such a strange contradiction and paradox. And a problem, I'm sure we're going to talk about this, Mark, sorry to cut you off, but is I don't feel like the media journalists have done a particularly bad job of understanding these contradictions.
Okay, let's talk about journalism. One of the chapters is on transparency. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation claims to be transparent and open. They built a new headquarters building in Seattle that's full of these large glass windows to demonstrate their transparency to the world. And yet it is very difficult to find out, in many cases, who's taking money from Gates. And in the world of journalism, that's a lot of organizations, as it turns out. And for radio listeners, let me just get to the punchline right away. You point out, Tim, that National Public Radio takes millions of dollars from the Gates Foundation. You also bring up that the program The Moth Radio Hour has received over $7 million in funding from Gates. And that's just radio. We could go into TV, broadcast media, and print journalism and elsewhere. But what should we know about Gates's reach into publications and channels and radio networks? And what does that do to the practice of journalism?
This is such a big part of the story, and it's something I write about as a journalist myself. I'm writing about the Gates Foundation in a media landscape larded with Gates Foundation funding. So the foundation has, that we can see, has donated more than, has donated hundreds of millions of dollars to news outlets. And there's very few news outlets that are untouched by the Gates Foundation's funding. If they're not taking a charitable grant from the foundation, then there are journalists on staff that are going to Gates-funded journalism trainings, or they have columnists on staff who have outside employment at a Gates-funded NGO that works on journalism. And this is part of a larger problem of, you know, there's another big $100 word here, but epistemic power. So this is like control over knowledge. The Gates Foundation's ability to write its own narrative and to tell its own story is really underappreciated. And they do this by putting hundreds of millions of dollars into journalism, but also billions of dollars into universities, and then also into NGOs, into think tanks, into even governments are taking funding from the Gates Foundation. So you have so many people and organizations, so many people who would otherwise be positioned to put a critical lens to the Gates Foundation to ask a challenging question. Once you are inside of the Gates financial sphere of influence, it becomes much harder to do that. And that's just the natural sticks and carrots, incentives and disincentives. You don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. And scholars have observed this for long enough that they even came up with this term, the bill chill, which is this chilling effect. Once you're funded by Gates, you're reluctant to bite the hand that feeds you. It's just kind of just common sense in the way the world works. But in a very real and practical sense, because the Gates Foundation is donating tens of billions of dollars, it can really control entire fields, maybe not monopolize them, but it can certainly exercise a great deal of influence. And there's a lot of caveats to that. There are a lot of scholars working in the social sciences, for example, like anthropology, sociology, geography, that Gates doesn't fund. There are always journalists like me who refuse Gates Foundation funding and have found a way to go over, under, around to get our work published. But I do think that it would be really ignorant and naive to imagine that the Gates Foundation's donating hundreds of millions of dollars to journalism, that that's charity, you know, that there's no strings attached and that it has no effect or no influence on how the news media covers Gates. Of course it does. You know, so many journalists over the years have observed how one-sided the news media is around the Gates Foundation. You know, the Seattle Times has reported this, Columbia Journalism has reported this, Vox has reported this. It's just a well-known, well-observed, one-sided bias. You know, reporting on the Gates Foundation tends to be about its big donations, its big audacious goals, about how generous Bill Gates is, treating Bill Gates as an expert or an authority, or as this kind of this great man, these big man stories. And there's a lot of reasons for that beyond the simple fact that Gates is donating money to the news media. I think part of it is also is that Gates presents a great hero narrative. He's this example of how capitalism can lift all boats. He made all of this money in private technology, and now he's giving it all away. It's like this irresistible narrative, especially I think for liberal media, a lot of mainstream liberal outlets whose sensibilities chime like so perfectly with that of the Gates Foundation. You know, Gates is the market-based solutions, all the neoliberal ideas working with and through corporations, win-win solutions. Everything the Gates Foundation does, it places very well within the sensibilities of a lot of kind of mainstream news outlets. So Gates certainly, I think, has a lot of advantages in the media landscape in terms of being able to donate money to them to buy influence, but also just sort of like swimming in the same water, breathing the same air, thinking like a lot of especially editors or publishers at elite news outlets think. So, you know, there are a lot of caveats to this. In my book, the last 150 pages are footnotes, endnotes in this huge bibliography. So there is a lot of great work, journalism and scholarship that has been published on Gates over the years. It's still the case, I think, that there is a lot of influence that the Gates Foundation has, which has really had a significant impact on the public debate, on the public discourse. It's the reason why we haven't really been able to have an open, honest debate about Bill Gates up until now.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst, and I am your host. We are halfway through my interview with journalist and author Tim Schwab, whose book is now out in paperback. It's called The Bill Gates Problem, Reckoning with the Myth of the Good Billionaire. And if you heard the first half of the interview, you have a sense of some of the aspects of the Bill Gates problem through Gates's work with his foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. If you'd like to join in the live listener chat, go to WFMU.org and click playlist and comments. Or go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and find the September 30, 2024 show. Now let's get back to my interview with Tim Schwab, author of The Bill Gates Problem, here on Tectonic. There's another type of donation that you cover in a chapter called lobbying. One number that stood out in this chapter was $12 billion. That's the amount of money that the foundation has given in so-called charitable grants to organizations in the Washington, D.C. area. You write that $12 billion is, quote, more than twice as much money as the foundation gives to the whole of Africa, a clear signal of where its real priorities lie.
What that does is that gives, it's a real signal of the Gates Foundation's presence and priorities in Washington, D.C. And it's no coincidence that Washington, D.C. is also the federal capital of the United States, where so many important decisions are made that affect the Gates Foundation's wealth and power. So an underappreciated facet of the Gates Foundation is how much of its charitable work is subsidized by us taxpayers. So what Bill Gates will do is he'll start a new public-private partnership like Gavi, which we discussed. It's this complex vaccine procurement mechanism. And Bill Gates will go around the world meeting with elected leaders, pressuring them to donate money to support Gavi. So tens of billions of dollars, taxpayer funds from taxpayers all over the world, go into supporting this project that Bill Gates, where the Gates Foundation has a permanent seat on the board of directors. And these are the kind of public-private partnerships that are working with Big Pharma. You know, again, Gates has his own narrow ideas about how to solve these problems, but then he's pressuring elected leaders and the rest of us taxpayers to subsidize this work. You know, these are tens of billions of dollars that could be going to a different model of pharmaceutical access or an entirely different public policy project altogether. You know, Bill Gates, he likes pharmaceuticals. There are a lot of ways to address public health that don't involve pharmaceuticals at all. You could be building clinics. You could be training doctors. You could be building roads that help people in poor villages get to clinics. Gates has a very, you know, he's the Microsoft guy. He likes products. He likes patented products. He likes technology. He likes major multinational companies. And the result is he has these very, very narrow and often wrong-headed ideas about how to solve these complex problems like public health. And then he goes around the world pressuring elected leaders to co-fund his big philanthropic ambitions. And we've never really had much of an public understanding or certainly a public debate about, is this a good use of public funds? Is this a good use of taxpayer funding? So I do just want to like be totally clear that the Gates Foundation is, it's not paying lobbyists directly. But I think if you look at the practical effect of what the foundation is doing is going around the world, pressuring government leaders to change priorities and to change spending in alignment with the Gates Foundation's ideas, I think it's hard to avoid that word when you're looking at that suite of activities.
Let's talk a little bit about agriculture, which, along with pharma, is one of the largest areas of investment. I'll start with this one quote that you have. Bill Gates has become the largest farmland owner in the United States, holding 242,000 acres. Tim, what is Bill Gates doing with all of that farmland?
It is a very good question. I don't know exactly. I mean, honestly, I've taken the position that it's just probably just another investment for Bill Gates. Keep in mind that this is a man with an estimated fortune of $130 billion. So where is that money invested? Everywhere. You know, Bill Gates is invested into everything and anything. And the fact that he's the largest farmland owner in the United States is, you know, even for someone like Gates, even at the level of wealth he has, that's still surprising. And I'd say it's still kind of disconcerting. I don't think it's a good thing for food systems, for agriculture production, whether at home or abroad, to have these super rich guys having so much influence over food production. And, you know, just to be clear, you know, Gates owns this farmland, but he's not actually a farmer. He's an investor. He's not on the farms. He has no practical knowledge of farming. He himself isn't somebody out there getting his hands dirty, certainly not on farms anyway. But he is very willing and eager to try to tell farmers across the African continent how they should grow food, how he thinks they should grow food, and to put in place sticks and carrots to try and move policymakers and regulators across the African continent to follow his priorities and his agenda for how he thinks African farmers should grow food.
There's something else you cover in the book that is different from pharmaceuticals and agriculture and those other sorts of investments, and that is the character of Bill Gates himself, personally. And I wanted to talk a little bit about this. You have a chapter on Gates's behavior around women, including women inside his foundation. You write that, quote, Bill Gates faced a number of allegations of personal misconduct from female employees at Microsoft and the Gates Foundation, unquote, all of which Gates has denied or downplayed. But here's the thing. These allegations, at least the ones at the Gates Foundation, came to light after the revelation of Bill Gates's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, who was already a convicted pedophile when Bill Gates agreed to have several meetings with him. What happened there?
I don't know that we're ever going to know the full truth of this very hard to explain association that Bill Gates had with Jeffrey Epstein. Yes, Jeffrey Epstein was a convicted felon at the time that Bill Gates met with him. The way he's explained it, so the news media, I'll say, has actually done a very good job with this story, trying to excavate the details of the Gates-Epstein association. And what Gates has always tried to say is that he met with Epstein to discuss fundraising for philanthropy. So, I find that very difficult to understand why Bill Gates, one of the richest guys in the world, would need Jeffrey Epstein's help raising money for philanthropy.
Right. I'm sorry to interrupt. In every other part of your book, I don't see any evidence of Bill meeting with connectors to other fellow rich people in order to pool their money with the foundation's money. He's always making these donations unilaterally. That reasoning from Gates just seems very hollow.
Well, I do think that Bill Gates is trying to cultivate a bigger field of philanthropy. He's created something called the Giving Pledge, where he's asking other billionaires around the world to follow in his footsteps to do what he's done, to give away more money. So he is interested in broadening the field of philanthropy. But what doesn't make sense to me is why in the world he would need Jeffrey Epstein's help. Bill Gates is not just one of the richest guys in the world, but he has an army of people surrounding him to protect his image, his reputation, his personal security. There's no way he did not know going into this meeting exactly who Jeffrey Epstein was or what a liability, the way that I try to understand it in the book is that there must be a sort of ends justifies the means rationale to sort of understand why Bill Gates was meeting with Jeffrey Epstein. That, if we are to take Gates's explanation at face value that he really was meeting with Epstein to raise money for philanthropy, then what else would he be willing to do to advance his philanthropic goals? If he's willing to meet with this convicted felon, sex offender, this monster by all accounts, what else would he be willing to do? And how else would he rationalize that other than the ends justifies the means? What else would he be willing to do? Jeffrey Epstein is dead. I don't know who else on earth would know the full story besides Bill Gates, but I can say that big news outlets like the Wall Street Journal, like the New York Times, that don't normally put a critical lens to Gates, have gone very hard on this story about Gates and Epstein and done some very good reporting which I leaned on in my book. So the full story, I don't know. I don't have like an alternative theory that I can put forward. Just a lot of it's what other people have reported. There's one explanation is that Jeffrey Epstein was a good facilitator for Bill Gates in his campaign to win a Nobel Peace Prize because Jeffrey Epstein had contacts that could put him sort of in closer to decision makers who were people who were positioned to influence the Nobel Peace Prize. Gates has denied that. But there is some good reporting by some journalists in, I think, in Norway who did some interesting reporting on that.
I just want to read one little piece just to finish up this Epstein bit that I thought was an important detail. you're speaking about Gates's denials about his relationship and association with Epstein. Quote, his denials were contradicted by the findings of journalists. While Gates said he hadn't got to, quote, Palm Beach or any of that, flight records, which had already been reported in the news media, showed that Gates had, in fact, flown on Epstein's plane to Palm Beach. The news media went on to report that Gates had met with the convicted sex offender multiple times at Epstein's home in Manhattan. Again, it just leaves a big question mark.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't understand. I mean, these kinds of contradictions, it just makes it harder and harder to believe the story. And it just raises more questions. And this is what's prompting investigative journalists to keep digging, to keep answering questions. You know, I think if he had been more forthcoming, you know, originally, we might be, you know, seeing things that we might be a little bit more charitable in trying to understand what the real story is. But right now, I feel like, yeah, you can look at those examples and you can look at other examples and you can judge for yourself. Do you think that we have the whole story or that there might be more to the story? And what is that more to the story?
Before we close, Tim, I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about solutions. You do such a good job in this book of describing the Bill Gates problem from a number of different angles, but the book does not end with just a problem. You're actually pointing us to some ways to maybe address this problem in the future. Here's what you write. The real solution to our Bill Gates problem is not simply for his foundation to be more transparent. It's for his foundation to lower its voice and unwind the accountable power structure it has built. And then at the end of the book, you offer some specific suggestions for how that unwinding could actually happen. You can describe some of those suggestions, but I want to layer in an additional question, which is how likely in the oligarchy that is emerging in our country right now, how likely are these solutions to come to pass?
I think it is very easy to become fatalistic and say, this is the world we live in. And it's that, I think, kind of fatalism that leads people to say, well, the best we can hope for is that our billionaires are good billionaires like Bill Gates giving away all their money and that our oligarchs are good oligarchs. So I take a different point of view, which is one of optimism, which is one of hope, which is one of inspiration, where I look around and you can see from Occupy Wall Street to the Green New Deal to decolonize global health to Black Lives Matter. To me, I think that the world really is turning in substantive, significant ways, and it's turning against the oligarchs. It's turning against the interests and the ideologies and the privileges and entitlements of this oligarchy class. I mean, yes, you know, we do live in a new gilded age with people like Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates and Elon Musk, and we can go on and on. But I do think that the makings are there to reimagine the world, to reimagine the economy. I think it's also just common sense. I think that people understand it doesn't make sense to build our economy, to create our democracy in such a way that a handful of people have $100 billion fortunes. Well, billions of people on Earth can't make basic ends meet. So those are political decisions. We have organized our economy in such a way to allow Bill Gates to become so obscenely wealthy. But that also means we can make other political decisions. I mean, to your point, though, this is a long-term political goal. I'm not saying that this is going to happen tomorrow or that all the ingredients are there or that we have the political will in Congress. Certainly, that's not the case to actually change. But I can tell you, you know, just this last week, you have news articles talking about how farmer organizations across the African continent are now calling on the Gates Foundation to pay reparations, to clean up the messes that they've caused through the wrong-headed charitable crusades. So I think that it's not just that the narrative is changing, but I do think that the political animus is changing and the actual political structure is changing too. I mean, what are the solutions to the Bill Gates problems? The easy solution, the politically expedient solution maybe, is to regulate philanthropy. Congress has not taken a hard look at private foundations in 50 years. 50 years ago, they were looking at the Ford Foundation. They were looking at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. But we live, you know, philanthropy has changed really significantly, and so has extreme wealth. Clearly, Congress, there's a lot of little things that Congress could do to make foundations like the Gates Foundation more accountable and less transparent. But yeah, the really big picture solution, and it's a longer term political goal, is to rethink about, you know, how we organize our economy and our democracy in such a in a way that's far more equitable, that's more just, that doesn't allow a small group of people to become so wealthy, that does not create this super class of oligarchs. You know, and I can't give you chapter and verse the exact points of how we're going to get there. But, you know, my point is, you know, why not be hopeful? Why not be optimistic? And why not, you know, recognize the problem, debate the solution, and actually fight for it and try and move forward? You know, to me, it's like there's no room for fatalism. We just don't have time. The things we're talking about, the sort of political struggles that I think we're talking about here, it's just too important.
I agree. That's a great response. And it's something I should keep in mind in my other shows as well, as I'm talking about other seemingly intractable problems caused by the handful of billionaires on the west coast of the U.S. who made their money from tech monopolies. It happens almost every week here.
Yeah, it's a big problem. It's a perennial problem. And it's very easy to feel sort of like outgunned and fatalistic. But I think that when you do that, you cede a lot of ground to this very destructive model.
Well, Tim, I really appreciate you ending with that note of optimism, and I appreciate the years of research it took to put this book together. As you said, the endnotes are incredibly extensive, and I recommend this book to Tectonic listeners. It's called The Bill Gates Problem, Reckoning with the Myth of the Good Billionaire, by my guest today, Tim Schwab. Tim, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate it.
And we're back. If you are just joining us, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining several minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Tim Schwab talking about his book, The Bill Gates Problem, Reckoning with the Myth of the Good Billionaire. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and it is now out in paperback. If you want a link to that book and some other items, you can go to the playlist at WFMU.org. Click Playlists and Comments, where we've had a good listener chat throughout the show. There's information about this show at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and you can get those links there. We spent the interview talking about a number of different aspects of Bill Gates and his foundation's work. One of the issues that we covered in the second half was Gates's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And I didn't get a chance to bring it up in the interview, but I wanted to bring it up here, which was that after that news broke in 2021, PBS NewsHour did something very interesting. The host at the time, Judy Woodruff, interviewed Bill Gates on other topics. And then at the very end of the interview, she asked him about Epstein. And there was this really interesting exchange. And I want to play that for you now because it shows just how uncomfortable and I guess awkward that kind of conversation is for Bill Gates, especially when it sounds like no one really asks him that kind of challenging question very often. Here it is. This is PBS NewsHour from September 2021.
I also want to ask you about something else in the public arena. It was reported at that time that you had a number of meetings with Jeffrey Epstein, who, when you met him 10 years ago, he was convicted of soliciting prostitution from minors. What did you know about him when you were meeting with him, as you've said yourself, in the hopes of raising money?
You know, I had dinners with him. I regret doing that. He had relationships with people he said, you know, would give to global health, which is a interest I have. You know, not nearly enough philanthropy goes in that direction. You know, those meetings were a mistake. They didn't result in what he purported, and I cut them off. You know, that goes back a long time ago now. So there's nothing new on that.
It was reported that you continue to meet with him over several years, and that, in other words, a number of meetings. What did you do when you found out about his background?
Well, and, you know, I've said I regretted having those dinners, and there's nothing, absolutely nothing new on that.
Is there a lesson for you, for anyone else looking at this?
Well, he's dead, so, you know, in general, you always have to be careful. I'm very proud of what we've done in philanthropy, very proud of the work of the foundation. That's what I get up every day and focus on.
Okay, so that was Bill Gates on PBS NewsHour in September 2021. As I think you can hear, it was a pretty awkward moment as Bill, I really doubt, had approved that kind of question beforehand. So good on PBS NewsHour and Judy Woodruff for asking that question. I guess in just to wrap things up, I only have a couple of minutes here. The Bill Gates problem, as we heard in the interview, is that we shouldn't have one person given all of the influence in all of these different areas to unilaterally make the decisions that affect billions of people. And that's, unfortunately, the system we have. As Tim Schwab pointed out, the oligarchy that is emerging, or perhaps is already here in our economy today, allows for someone like Bill Gates to ascend to that very non-democratic point of extreme power, of unaccountable power. He's got power on the level of a nation state, and he was never elected, and there's no one you can appeal to. There's no elected official you can appeal to take him out of that position. And it's not just Gates. I mean, we can see the kinds of things that Elon Musk is doing, that Mark Zuckerberg is doing, that Jeff Bezos is doing, that very quietly the Google founders are doing. We have these tech billionaires who are making sweeping decisions every day that affect people all over the world. And what is our power against them? As Tim said, the best that some people can come up with is, well, let's just hope that these billionaires make decisions that we're going to find tasteful and just and equitable. And if you just look at the track record, of what these guys have done so far, you tell me if you think the future is going to be filled with justice and equity based on these West Coast billionaires making all the decisions on our behalf. Personally, I would rather have a democracy. As I've said a number of times on the show, this really is not a political issue of left versus right. This is an issue of tech billionaires versus the rest of us. And I'll leave you with that, friends. Thanks again to Tim Schwab for being on the show. And if you want more information on the show, go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And the show with Tim Schwab is going to have some links on the playlist for you to dive in and read more and make your own decisions. But I hope you have found this helpful. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, I've got some homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. Oh, and speaking about those mercurial billionaires who are making decisions that don't necessarily benefit the rest of us, here's a song about the something owned by one of them with a helpful suggestion. Here it is by John Dogg. Have a great week, everybody.
And
have you heard it decreed? This is a joyous day indeed. Twitter must die, Twitter must die, Twitter must die. As if from an awful dream, the world awoke amid a scream of Twitter must die, Twitter must die, Twitter must die. Setting aside the usual rivalries, the United Nations has proclaimed, for petty crimes against humanity, Twitter will be shot in the brain, set on fire and thrown from a plane. Yes, it's for your own good. You disagree, but then you would. Twitter must die, Twitter must die, Twitter must die. We pleaded, we cajoled, but you were busy being trolled. Now Twitter must die, Twitter must die, Twitter must die. Like poor old Smeagol and his precious ring, or a devotee of crack cocaine, you were enchanted by the wretched thing, always insisting that you're in control, as you scroll and you scroll and scroll, and scroll. Have you heard? You won't believe, there's been a last-minute reprieve. Now Twitter won't die, Twitter won't die, Twitter won't die. As its head was in the noose, a mob arrived to cut it.
And welcome to another exciting episode of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here bringing this show to you every Monday evening at 7 p.m., immediately following, hot on the heels of Mark Hurst and the Tectonic Program. Pleasure to be here playing music for you always. And a lot of good stuff in store for you tonight. And we're going to start, let's start off with some crazy French music. Some crazy French music is always a good way to start the show. And I'm going to play a band that I've played before, not many times, maybe once before, but a favorite of mine, big favorite of mine, French band called Etrange Fou. A lot of you will know of them. They were Etrange Fou Le Loup Blanc was the full band name. And even in French, it's kind of nonsense. It's not particularly meaningful name. They were members of the collective called Rock in Opposition, RIO, and great, great, great French, really indescribable band, certainly proggy, but pretty much indescribable. And as you will hear, the singer, leader, I don't know if he was the leader, singer of the band, front man of the band, was a guy named Ferdinand Richard, who played a six-string bass mostly. And it's incredible, frenetic music, really big favorites of mine. So we're going to hear a track from an album released in 1979 called Les Trois Fous. And this is Etrange Fou. Enjoy. Thank you.
de ces berges bétonnées. Tu roules. Le long du Rhône, dans ta bagnole froide, tu roules. Marcher sans manger. Refouler, ces brusques envies de confort. Voyager encore, toujours. Tu t'arrêtes. Et sans violence.
Tu te laisses couler dans les eaux métalliques du grand fleuve. Parmi les poissons morts et les atomes vivants.
Dude.